There are three incidents of Exodus in Jewish history. There is the Exodus from Egypt, recent Exodus from a global diaspora. The first Exodus followed an exile of some 400 years, according to our tradition. The second, an exile of some 50 years. And the third, last, an exile of some 2,000 years. From Egypt, according to our traditions, some 600,000 Jews returned to Palestine. From Babylon, some 40,000. Because the Babylonian exile was always a partial exile. And from this last world dispersion, some 1.5 million have returned ever since the movement of return began in the early 80s of the last century, and this exodus is still continuing. There are some strange and instructive similarities in these three incidents of Exodus in our history. Though 3,000 years separates the first Exodus from the last. These similarities are very instructive, especially to students of the philosophy of Jewish history and of the psychology of our people. In each instance, deliverance came at the moment of darkest despair, of greatest suffering, and of the lowest point of national morale. In the case of Egypt, the people had reached a breaking point. Never had their lives as the slaves of Pharaoh been as embittered with hard service. Never have the burdens put upon them been so grievous and heavy. Never were the taskmasters so cruel and exacting. And to top all these cruelties and indignities, the decree was now issued that all the male children born unto the Israelites were to be thrown into the Nile. And so the people groaned under their bondage, as the Bible puts it, "Vayanchu bnei Yisrael min ha'avodah." At that darkest moment, at the breaking point, Moses, the deliverer, appeared. In the case of the Babylonian exile, the exiles had come to believe that their end had come. By the rivers of Babylon, they sat down and wept. Our bones are dried up. Our hope is lost. We are clean cut off. In this mood of utter dejection did the prophet Ezekiel, the prophet of the exile, find the people, his exiled brethren. And at this darkest moment, the powerful empire of Babylon fell suddenly under the crushing might of Persia. And to quote the biblical chronicler, The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation, whosoever is among you of all his people of Judah who desires to return, may the Lord his God be with him, let him go up. And in the case of the present Exodus, need we be reminded that it came at the moment when the Nazis were systematically exterminating the Jewish people, and the greatest disaster in Jewish history was being recorded in blood, in terror, and in death. And at this moment, the darkest in the history of 2,000 years of exile and persecution, when it seemed as if the whole people of Europe was to be completely annihilated. At this moment, the representatives of the nations of the world gathered in Flushing, New York, voted in favor of the reestablishment of the Jewish state in Palestine, and a few months later, the State of Israel was proclaimed and the great ingathering began. These are strange similarities of Jewish history. And this has led the faithful among our people to two firm convictions. First, that persecution and exile may occur at any time in ancient Egypt, in Babylon, in medieval Spain, in modern Germany. And secondly, a quote from the book of Nehemiah, whose name is identified with the second restoration, thou didst give them into the hand of the peoples of the lands, but in thy great mercies thou didst not utterly make an end of them or forsake them. And this, you will recall, is summarized in the Haggadah of Passover. There's a very beautiful and magnificent verse in the Haggadah which reads something like this. And this is the established law of our existence in the case of our forefathers and in our case. Namely, that not one tyrant only arose in the past to destroy us. Ela, שבכל דור ודור עומדים עלינו לחלותינו. In every generation, tyrants arise to destroy us. והקדוש ברוך הוא מצילנו מידם. And the Holy One, blessed be He, delivers us. At the moment of greatest crisis, from their hands. This is the invincible faith. This is the inveterate optimism which has sustained our people. This is the eternal fire. It's a beautiful legend told in the Talmud. When the temple in Jerusalem was about to be destroyed, and the altar upon which was the eternal flame was to be broken, the priests took the fire from that altar, about to be destroyed, and hid it. And where was it hidden? In the soul of the people. And never was there a generation of Jews that lacked something of this eternal flame, the hope, the faith, the optimism, in spite of the direst of circumstances. There are a lot of similarities between these three exoduses, if I might use the term. In each instance, Egypt, Babylon today, in each instance, the people as a whole, that is all the Jews, the people as a whole was not prepared for exodus and freedom. Some were. And these were the rebuilders, the restorers. But many, perhaps most, were not prepared. In the case of Egypt, many Israelites had become accustomed to their chains, as it were. They would not risk the minimum security which servitude gave them. They would not risk, as the Bible put it, the melon and the leeks and the onions and the garlics. They would groan under the yoke. They would lament when the yoke became too galling. But at last, the pride and the hope and the faith and the courage to attempt to throw off the yoke. They mistrusted themselves. They mistrusted their leader. I read you from Psalm 106 this morning. He et rucho, they made the soul of Moses bitter by their constant nagging and their distrust, their criticism. They resented him when he failed in his intercession with the Pharaoh. And when Pharaoh, as a result, placed increased burdens upon the people, they resented Moses. And they said, "You have made us offensive in the sight of Pharaoh. May the Lord look upon you and judge you and punish you." They were not willing to go along with their leader in the initial stages of failure and defeat, looking towards ultimate victory. And at the Red Sea, when they found themselves with the sea in front of them and the Egyptians pursuing them and approaching them, and they saw death staring them in the face, they cried to Moses, "Is it because there are no graveyards in Egypt that you have taken us away to die here in the wilderness? Did we not tell you time and again, let us alone? Let us be slaves to the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to be slaves to the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." This is a far cry from free men who say, "Give me liberty or give me death." This is the snarl of slaves who feel themselves somehow betrayed when the freedom is denied them momentarily. They did not trust their leader. It was only after they crossed the Red Sea and they found themselves secure that the Bible says, "Vayaminu b'Adonai," they trusted the Lord with the Moshe Avdo and Moses' servant. But even then, only for a short time, after they crossed the Red Sea, and the difficulties of the journeys presented themselves to them, and the hunger and the thirst and the hardships, they again began to rebel. They rebelled against the Lord. They built themselves a golden calf and went back to the idolatry of Egypt. They rebelled against Moses, Korach, and his henchmen, And time and again Moses said, "Open up, the east colonial. I think that before long these people will stone me to death." And that was true of many of the Jews of that generation. Fortunately, not of all. In the case of the Babylonian Exodus, the records do not tell us how the Jews reacted to the call of Zerubbabel, the prince, who sought to bring him back to Judea. The records are very meager. But judging by the rather limited number of those who did return, and most of them belonged to the priestly families who returned to rebuild the temple, judging by the limited number who did return from the Babylonian exile, the call of Zerubbabel went unheeded and was ignored by many of them who preferred to remain in exile. But concerning the great personality whose name is associated with the recent Exodus, with the restoration and the rebuilding of Israel, the founder of political Zionism, Dr. Theodor Herzl, the records are abundant. And they all tell of continuous and incessant attacks upon him, misrepresentation, mockery, calumny, from all quarters, from the extreme Orthodox right to the extreme assimilationist left. In his diaries, Dr. Theodor Herzl writes on the date of October 13, 1896, "I must frankly admit to myself I am demoralized, from no side help, from every side attacks. Nordau writes me that nobody stirs any longer in Paris. The Maccabees in London are more Pickwickian than ever. In Germany, I have only opponents. The Russians look on sympathetically while I slave away, and none of them lends a hand. The prosperous Jews are all against me." And on the date of December 20th of the same year, he writes, "I feel that I am growing exhausted. Oftener than ever, I believe that my movement is at an end. While I'm still absolutely convinced of its feasibility, I cannot overcome its initial difficulties." And yet something of this indomitable faith of which I spoke a moment ago, this unquenchable hopefulness, was with this leader. For on September 3rd of the following year, 1897, following the first Zionist Congress in Basel, he writes in his diaries, "If I were to sum up the Congress in a word, which I shall take care not to publish, it would be this: at Basel, I founded the Jewish state. If I said this out loud today, I would be greeted by universal laughter. In 5 years, perhaps, and certainly in 50 years, everyone will perceive it." And Dr. Theodor Herzl missed his guess by exactly 8 months. Well, 50 years after he wrote this, the State of Israel was proclaimed. And there is still another similarity between the three Exoduses that I should like to draw your attention to. And that is the pain and the struggle and the sacrifice which were involved. The terrible price which had to be paid by people which wishes to be free and find the promised land. After the Jews left Egypt, danger lurked at every step of their journey. For 40 years in the wilderness, they face thirst and hunger. In a land, as the Bible puts it, of desert and pits, in a land of drought and deep darkness, in a land where no man dwells. 40 years they wandered through that land. And they faced enemies on all sides. And finally, when they reached the promised land and crossed the Jordan into Canaan, they had to fight every inch of the way before they could establish themselves in the land. It's not easy for a people to win freedom. And the exiles who returned from the Babylonian captivity, if you read your books of Ezra and Nehemiah, encountered enemies on all sides who united, who allied themselves to check the returning exiles from rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and thus consolidating their strength. And they informed against them in the court of Persia. And the government put a stop to their rebuilding of the walls. And finally, when they did proceed with rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, again to use the biblical phrase, half of them worked on construction, and half of them held the spears and the shields and the bows and the coats of mail to defend themselves against attack. Nothing came easy to our people seeking freedom. And those who are acquainted with modern Jewish history know the epic of struggle and sacrifice, of sweat, tears, and blood, which preceded the establishment of the State of Israel, which attended the third Exodus. Recently, the full story of this third Exodus was told in an impassioned historical novel, significantly called Exodus, written by Leon Uris. This book was reviewed here in the temple pulpit by Rabbi Daniel a few months ago, and I will not retrace his steps. For me, the interest of the book lies not so much in the novel end of it, in the plot, so to speak. For me, the interest in this book, which I am happy that it has caused such a tremendous stir among our people, and Jews are reading, because Jews are beginning to read about their own history and enjoy it and feel pride in it. This book is of interest to me because it narrates in intense and dramatic form, however embellished the story may be, and in spite of his journalese style, which is compounded at times of Hollywood and Madison Avenue, which at times is self-defeating because of that, the book nevertheless does recount on a high plane of literary merit, fascinating and enthralling, the 75-year epic struggle for the restoration of Israel. It's true that the book is more story than history. Nevertheless, all the significant facts of this three quarters of a century, which led to the establishment of Israel, are recorded and described in this book in great detail, sometimes with great moving pathos. The horrors of, for example, of the concentration camps and of the Nazi persecution are depicted here. And yet there are, one feels, sorrows too deep for tears and tragedies too stark for words. But the book does recapture something of the tragedy, of the tensions, of the horrors, and of the all epic struggle of 75 years on the part of dedicated sons and daughters of Israel to rebuild the Jewish homeland. In this book, the Russian pogroms of the early 80s are there. The beginning of the Zionist movement with the Chovav Etzion and the Bilu, the establishment of the first Zionist colonies in Palestine, the spread of anti-Semitism in Western Europe, in France, the Dreyfus Affair, Theodor Herzl, the first Zionist Congress, the Balfour Declaration, and everything incidental to it, the First World War, the mandate granted Great Britain over Palestine, and of the subsequent efforts on the part of Great Britain to whittle it down and to minimize its significance in order to placate the Arabs and to ensure its oil in that part of the world. The attempts to interfere with Jewish resettlement, the Palestine riots of 1929, the rise of the Nazis, the all-out onslaught of the Nazis against the Jews, the policy of genocide, concentration camps, gas chambers, the destruction of the ghetto of Warsaw, and the flight of the Jews to Palestine, and then the British White Paper, restricting Jewish immigration to a pitiful small number at the time when hundreds of thousands sought to escape the death trap of Europe. The Aliyah death, the illegal immigration, those tramp ships with their load of human misery trying to get to the shores of Palestine and turned away by the British blockade, Cyprus and the concentration camps, and finally the surrender of the British mandate to the United Nations, and the final grabber at Flushing Meadows, the resolution of the United Nations, the partition of Palestine, the proclamation of the State of Israel in 1948, and the War of Liberation. All these tremendous moments in what is undoubtedly the most exciting three quarters of a century in Jewish history, the most appalling in many ways, the most dramatic and the most heroic. All these are recorded in this book, and they build up to one of the most dramatic epics of all times, greater than any book can encompass. I'm not much inspired by the people in this novel, people who carry the plot of the story, this iron cast hero, so to speak, this tough, almost mechanical monster, and by the heroine, an American Christian nurse, and some of the other characters. They're more or less stereotyped, and they often speak in cliches and spout a lot of propaganda. In fact, the whole story of these 300 children were put on board ship in one of the harbors of Cyprus in an effort to break the British blockade. And the hunger strike among these children. And finally the threat to have 10 of them commit suicide in order to force the hand of Great Britain to let the ship go. All this is pure fiction. Never happened. although there were children, many children, and some of these other tramp ships that tried to get to Palestine, there were children on the Struma and the Patria, which sank, one near the Bosphorus, another in the very site of Haifa, because the British refused to permit these people to disembark. The tragedy of these young and old can never be fully told. But this book does recapture the drama of those desperate years and the indomitable courage of the men and women who built Israel, their capacity to endure and to fight and to build. It does give you, more than any book that I've read in recent times, something of the pride and nobility of Jewish life under stress, under danger, in the face of hopelessness. And I can well understand why Jews are fond of this book. The very Jews who somehow were not stirred when these events took place, and they were told about them as cold facts. Some of them remained unmoved. But in the form of a well-written novel, these facts somehow make a tremendous impact upon them, and that is all to the good. There are therefore three lessons that we may learn from these incidents of Exodus. First, never to despair. The hour is darkest before dawn. That is, I might almost say, a truism of Jewish history. Secondly, to prepare ourselves so as to be worthy of freedom. Prepare ourselves through self-discipline and self-confidence and trust in dedicated leadership. And finally, to be prepared to pay the price for freedom. Not only for the freedom of the Jewish people, but for the freedom of mankind, for the freedom of our own country, for all kinds of liberation which help man to knock off all chains and to rise to the higher levels in the purer air of life. Freedom is something to be bought and paid for by loyalty and sacrifice, oftentimes by struggle and pain and suffering. And that is true of our personal lives as well. There is a story told in the Midrash of Moses, the hero of Passover. A great king had heard of this emancipator Moses. And had a portrait painted of him. And when the king saw the portrait, he found in it so much that was unattractive, in a way repellent, qualities which he never associated with Moses. Almost ugliness in certain features of the portrait of this great man. And he called together his wise men and showed them this portrait. And they too said, this man whose portrait you have shown us must be a very unworthy man, because the features of this portrait seem to indicate a certain low qualities of character in the man. The king couldn't believe it, couldn't trust his wise men, couldn't trust himself. Finally, he invited Moses to come to him. Moses came. When he saw Moses, he was impressed with the majesty and the dignity and the beauty of the man. And he pointed to the portrait and asked Moses, "Is this your portrait? Does this represent you?" And Moses said, "Yes, this represents me as I was. All these qualities were in me. Ruthlessness, cruelty, selfishness, they were all there. But through the years I sought to master them, to sublimate them, to suppress all that was evil in me. And thank God I was able to do so." Moses still went forth in his personal life into a sort of an exodus from darkness to light, from slavery to freedom, from baseness to magnificent spiritual elevation. Every human being has to do that. None of us is born an angel. But we have to learn to be prepared to pay the price of effort and struggle and self-discipline to be free in ourselves, and to be free as members of our society and our collective life. There's a great message for all of us in this immortal story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, which this festival of Passover, for more than 3,000 years, has commemorated.